let's get started with what's going on right now between Russia and Ukraine. And recently we had a Ukrainian offensive on Russian soil. In your opinion, when it comes to the NATO's strategy right now in Ukraine, what's their main plan in your opinion, and what was behind this strategy on going on Russian soil and attacking on the Kursk region?
Well, I think the whole purpose of it is to keep escalating against Russia, with the aim essentially to provoke Russia into doing some major reaction, which would, in the view of the present NATO planners, discredit Russia. If you look at, for example, the Times of London, I think of today or yesterday, they basically say, you know, that the Western countries are much too conservative. They are always afraid of escalation, but that the whole behavior of Russia would have shown that there are no red lines. Putin is just bluffing. And I think that line is extremely dangerous, because that propaganda line of NATO, which is transmitted through all the mainstream media, essentially has succeeded to a certain extent to lull in parts of the population to say, oh, you know, there is no problem, there are no red lines, we can escalate ever more heavy weapons, let the Ukrainians use them deep into the territory of Russia, nothing will ever happen. And I think NATO, I think one has to look at the totality. We just found out from the New York Times yesterday that already in March, President Biden agreed to sign a new U.S. nuclear strategy, which is top secret. There are apparently not even electronic copies of it, only a few printed ones who go in the hands of very trusted national security people. And, you know, that, according to the little information known about it, is assumes that the United States, and therefore NATO, will have to deal with the three countries, Russia, China, and North Korea, simultaneously. Naturally, all of them are nuclear powers. So this, you know, in a certain sense, I think the collective West has been gripped by a madness. I mean, I'm in politics for a long time, but I still, you know, somehow try to understand how can people be so absolutely irresponsible and gamble with, if it goes wrong, leads to the complete annihilation of the human species. Because, you know, I have studied the difference between conventional war and nuclear war. There are excellent writings by former MIT professor Ted Postol and others who have made very convincing arguments that once you use one nuclear weapon, it's the logic of that type of weapons that eventually all will be used, which means, you know, that you will have the destruction of civilization 10 times over, followed by a nuclear winter of maybe 10 years, so absolutely no life on the planet will be left. And that's what these people are gambling with. So I think what is the plan of NATO is, you know, they have said it, you know, through the words of Baerbock, the foreign minister of Germany, ruin Russia, Austin saying, you know, weaken Russia. You know, they are obsessed, and, you know, in a certain sense, the demonization of Russia, and now more and more the enemy picture of China, it is purely ideological. It's an obsession, it's a mental disease in my view, I think the more people wake up to that reality, the better.
And in your opinion, how did you find the attitude of Russia? Because in the West, when I talk with people like Paul Carrick Roberts, he believes that the way that Russia is handling the conflict with Ukraine it's going to be perceived by the West as Russia's weakness, as Russia's. But we know that at the end of the day, he's so cautious. Boom, I'm talking about Putin and his administration. He's so cautious. He's so prone for this conflict in Ukraine, even with this attack on the Kursk region. And do you think, why is the West thinking that Russia is, if that's the case, if the mindset is Russia is afraid of us, Russia is afraid of escalation, Russia is not going to attack Ukraine, which wasn't the case, finally the Russia attacked Ukraine. And these assumptions were totally wrong, and it seems to be in the future will be wrong on the part of NATO, but it doesn't seem that they're thinking that let's go the other direction, let's find some sort of solution, some sort of negotiating settlement. And they didn't choose that direction, and right now attacking on Russian soil, which is so important, which is so different from what we've seen so far in Ukraine. How do you see the mindset of NATO right now?
Well, I think that, since quite some time, they believe in their own doctrine. And I'm pretty sure that there are some people think that they can win a nuclear war. Because if you look at the strategy of China, they have explicitly no first use. The Russian nuclear strategy is to say that they only will use nuclear weapons when the territorial integrity of Russia is in danger. So they think that, you know, by maybe, and, you know, in the recent period, we had several conferences where we had speakers who participated in NATO maneuvers. And several of them testified that they were horrified when they saw with what ease the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons was ordered always by the Americans. And there was no concern for the existence of Germany, for example, dropping some nuclear bombs on German territory. Well, that's part of the game. And I think that, you know, these people have completely dissociated themselves from the reality of what the consequences of war is. You know, I think that, you know, I'm not of the war generation, but I remember the stories of my parents and relatives, you know, who did participate in the Second World War. And, you know, people have forgotten how destroyed the cities were, how, you know, I mean, and I think the present planners of NATO are reckless, they're irresponsible. If they would, you know, be, they don't listen, obviously, to the International Court of Justice or International Criminal Court. But, you know, in a certain sense, one could argue that to prepare a war of aggression is a crime, you know. And naturally, you know, if you want to bring somebody to court, you have to have the power to do so. And that, obviously, in the present situation doesn't exist. But I can only say that if you look at these war plans, you're really talking with very problematic mindsets, to say the least.
Yeah. And here comes the role of Germany, which is so important, in my opinion, in the European Union. And what we've seen from Germany when this conflict started, they were so hesitant to send weapons, to send aid to Ukraine, even participating in this conflict. And right now we see a totally different attitude coming out of Germany. Even in the bill, in the German publication, says Russia, German tanks on Russian soil. And the question that comes to my mind is, how is Germany benefiting from this conflict? Germany is losing more than in any country in the European Union. And at the end of the day, you see this excitement within Germany.
It's both a tragedy and also, in a certain sense, a farce, you know, because this present so-called streetlight coalition government, which we have, they are being laughed at in the whole world, you know, as complete vessels of the Anglosphere. I mean, when Scholz was in Washington in February 22, that was before the special military operation started, there was this famous press conference where he was standing beside Biden, and he was asked by a reporter, what about Nord Stream pipelines? And Biden then answered and said, oh, we will have ways to do away with this. We have the means to do so. And Scholz was standing there like a little schoolboy and only could utter something stupid like, you know, we do everything together, you know. I mean, the whole world is laughing about that because, you know, now you have this new story published by the Wall Street Journal that supposedly Zelensky knew about it, that Zaluzhny did it despite it's a whole complicated story. I think this is a cover story. It's causing a lot of unhappiness because, you know, the initial cover story was that it was Russia itself. Ursula von der Leyen, for example, insinuated that. Now they're a little bit more unhappy because if it's Ukraine, then why should Germany pay billions and billions of euros for weapons to Ukraine when Ukraine was involved in committed an act of war and an act of terrorism against Germany? I mean, look, the implication and consequences of what happened is unbelievable because the Nord Stream 2 pipelines not only cut Germany off cheap Russian gas. You know, we are paying now three times as much for energy than almost every other country on the planet. The German economy, as a result of all of that, including the sanctions against Russia, is in a free fall. We are losing everything which, you know, everything which was built up after the Second World War, middle-level industry, the whole social system which goes with it, all of that goes down the drain. But the economic impact is just one element because, you know, the more larger geostrategic aim of those who did it was obviously to cut Germany off any relationship with Russia. Now, I don't know if that is the final word of wisdom, but, you know, the George Friedman, who is a known American strategist, he made this famous interview, which is quoted all the time, that it is since a long time the view of the US, and I would add the British, you know, the British emphatically as well, that the combination of German science and technology and know-how and the vast resources of Russia together would mean that there would be a competitor in the Eurasian landmass who would be more powerful than the United States. And therefore, that relationship has been targeted. I mean, one could say that for sure, because if you look at what happened with the Rapallo process, you know, when Germany tried to escape from the prison of the Versailles Treaty by turning to Russia in the Rapallo Treaty, within 1 year, all participants in the Rapallo Treaty were dead one way or another. And, you know, and in a similar way, naturally, I mean, I find this whole, and I the only reason why I'm not getting desperate is because I know not all Germans are like that. For example, we have now in a few, actually in less than 2 weeks, we have elections in three East German states. And I expect a crushing collapse of the coalition government parties. The SPD probably will have a hard time of making the 5% they need to get into the parliament. The FDP will vanish. The Greens hopefully will vanish as well. And the new parties which are coming up have a distinctly different view on Russia and Ukraine. So, and I think also in the German population, there is a minority which is waking up. But I think, you know, I find it, you know, I find it personally extremely disturbing. I mean, if you think that it was the Germans who, you know, were a large factor in, you know, causing 27 million people to die in the Second World War, which for the Russians up to the present day is still a much, much important issue. The Great Patriotic War is in their memory very fresh. So despite of that, you know, I thought that the behavior of the Soviet Union in the end phase in respect to the German unification was extremely generous. I mean, there was no use of force. There was an agreement that Germany could be part of the West, part of NATO. And, you know, the promises given by Baker III, the Secretary of State at the time, to Gorbachev, the NATO will not move one inch to the east. that was given. I mean, there are enough time witnesses who testify that that promise was an absolute important element of the peaceful unification of Germany, and that the Germans would have, you know, forgotten that and turn around and make Russia the enemy again. I find this shameful behavior. And, you know, I can only say, for example, if you look at the first speech Putin gave in the German parliament in 2001, it was optimistic. It was making one offer after the other about the Eurasian, you know, Eurasian security architecture. He even spoke German for some part of the speech, you know, quoting German poets and so forth. So there was a real opportunity to build a new security structure, you know, like, for example, when the Soviet Union disintegrated, my late husband and myself, who was still alive at that time, Lyndon LaRouche, we proposed the Eurasian land bridge because, you know, the Iron Curtain had vanished. It was the possibility to have a completely new security architecture based on joint economic development. And what was more obvious than to connect the population and industrial centers of Europe with those of Asia through economic development corridors? That would have been the very solid economic basis for a new security and development architecture. And, you know, obviously for geostrategic reasons, this was sabotaged by Bush, the Bush senior administration, by Margaret Thatcher, by Mitterrand. And however, you know, we took that proposal and organized for it in five continents. We had hundreds of conferences and seminars on the issue. And the idea now is very well alive in the form of the Belt and Road Initiative, the new Silk Road pushed by China. You have the BRICS Plus. You have the Global South, all oriented towards a new economic system. So I think, you know, I mean, NATO for sure, if they have their way and, you know, global NATO expands, and you have today an article in the, I think, American National Security Journal, a person called Michael, I forgot his name now. In any case, he basically says the Taiwan should learn from the Ukrainian offensive in Kursk, that they should destroy certain infrastructure in China, causing millions of people to die. Nothing will happen. I mean, this madness, you know, I mean, we absolutely have to make sure that that is not what will happen, because it would be, you know, so easy to come out of this situation if we can convince enough forces, individuals, groups, industry, middle-level entrepreneurs and others, that the very interest of European nations, for example, would be to cooperate with this new emerging economic system, you know, which is already the majority of the world. You have the BRICS, BRICS Plus. You have now, I think, 9 official members of the BRICS already in Kazan this year in October. I'm sure that there will be several new members, even if they want to go slow, not to make it too hastily. But I think, you know, more than 40 countries already have expressed their desire to also join the BRICS. That is the majority of the world population. If you count the people living in these countries, it's 85% of the human population. It's 70% of the GDP. So if you look at a country like Germany, it's an export-oriented nation. We have almost no raw materials, but we had a very high living standard because we had high export rates and high science and technological throughput. So for us, the only way to survive as an industrial nation would be to ally with the global south. And I think that, you know, if you look at some of these countries, you know, Indonesia soon will bypass Germany in terms of economic power. Much of Asia has incredible growth rates while Europe is collapsing. The US real economy is collapsing, not the finance sector, but the real economy. So I think, you know, we have to somehow try to get reason into this political situation by convincing, you know, the countries of Europe to ally with the global south. And I think that would be the only thing which would shock the United States if they would see that their so-called allies, which are not allies right now, but vessels, if they would turn around and actually say, no, we don't go along in this direction, which can only lead to the catastrophe of all of mankind. So I think it's extremely dangerous, but it's not hopeless, you know, because the way out of this crisis is clearly already there.
Yeah. The important point that you've mentioned is how the European Union is capable of doing this without the United States. And everybody right now is thinking that, considering Germany, and when it comes to Germany and German economy, how they can manage the economy without Russian energy, this cheap Russian energy that was going through the Nord Stream pipeline, and right now they don't have it. And it doesn't seem that any country right now is capable of providing Germany with that type of energy with the same kind of price. And how, in your opinion, at the end of the day, in the German culture, in the German government, do they really perceive that without Russia is not, they're not be able to manage their economy, to get better and overcome these difficulties that they're having right now? Or they're thinking that without Russia, just getting closer to the United States, which is not the energy coming from the United States, is 3, 4, 5 times, and in terms of the price that comes to Germany. But do they really think that at the end of the day, they have to have some sort of relationship with Russia, or they're just ignoring what Russia is and how important Russia is for their economy, for their growth?
Well, I think that, you know, we never had such an incompetent government in the entire post-war history in Germany. I mean, we used to have, you know, leaders you may not have agreed with, but they had stature, they had knowledge, they knew what diplomacy was. Now we have a crop of politicians in these positions. You know, I mean, we have a foreign minister for whom the word diplomacy is an alien notion. She probably never heard it. We have an economic minister who used to be an author of children's books, and he should have stayed with that profession. I think these people have no respect for what previous generations did. I think they are captured by, you know, their neoliberal ideology, which, you know, goes with all kinds of post, I think the Russian foreign minister Lavrov once called it post-Christian values.
You're back.
I can still hear you.
You're back.
I can still hear you. Okay. No, I was just saying that these people, these government people, are so incompetent that they are believing their own ideology, which Russian foreign minister Lavrov called once a post-Christian value set. And I think, you know,
they're having some sort of issues here.
Oh, I don't know what to do.
You're back.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You're back. Go on.
Okay, let's try again. No, I mean, the problem is that, you know, the in Germany, you have right now a group of politicians in power, liberals, the FDP. They are, you know, they're not even the old liberals anymore, like Genscher and the people who really thought that liberty means something. Now they are just, everything goes, you know, there are no standards anymore. There is they don't understand the economy, you know. I mean, you cannot have a highly industrialized economy like Germany and go to energy flux densities in the production process, which only suits an agrarian society. If you only have solar and wind power, which has very low energy flux density, then, you know, it's clear that these industries, which are energy dependent and have a high consumption of energy, they go abroad or they go bankrupt. You have right now an outflow of investment into the United States, into China, and the bankruptcy wave is skyrocketing. So I think, you know, I have the feeling that we are heading for an extremely hard period ahead of time, because, you know, everybody goes bankrupt: shop owners, restaurant owners, vineyard growers, farmers. And this realization that with the income of these formerly productive branches, the very educated and highly skilled social system was financed. So that will break away. And now you have the effort by this defense minister Pistorius. Can you imagine? He's calling for an open militarization. He says he wants to make Germany war ready. You know, and who should pay for all of that? Naturally, you look at the budget and all the social areas are being cut. Money for KITAs, for children, childcare, money for education, money for healthcare. They are closing hospitals right and left. You go throughout Germany, I don't know how many dozens of hospitals are being closed, so that the actual care for the population is what suffers. Now, that means we are moving in a very dangerous way in the direction of a Schachtian war economy. And, I think this all will fall apart. I don't think the EU is doing that well because, you know, I mean, you have some countries like Hungary and Prime Minister Orban, who did the only reasonable thing when Hungary assumed the chairmanship of the European Union. The first thing he did is he went on the second day to Kiev talking to Zelensky. Then he talked to Putin, then to Xi Jinping. He traveled from Beijing directly to Washington to the NATO summit. From there, he went to Mar-a-Lago talking to Trump. And he, you know, was extremely useful because he, you know, made the road to diplomacy open again. Now, what happens? Ursula von der Leyen is basically threatening Hungary. They don't do any major meetings now for half a year in Budapest. Now, there are other countries in Europe who agree with Orban, Slovakia, for example. Other countries in the Balkans really have second thoughts. Italy is very divided. Look at France. France is in a chaos. After the parliament election, they could not even form a government. And you have basically, I expect a bloodshed in terms of the election result for the coalition government on the 1st of September. So I think Europe is going into a turmoil, and the effort to push through this militarization, 2% of the budgets for military buildup, and even, you know, some are demanding more. This will not function. I think the social cohesion of Europe will disintegrate. And that is why I think we have to put on the agenda the alternative. The alternative is to say, let's replace confrontation with cooperation. You know, we in Europe should have a good relationship to the BRICS countries. You know, we should cooperate with the global majority. And, you know, the United States would be left to either, you know, do their thing on their own or, you know, join the European doing that. And if, I mean, people are afraid to do that. They're even afraid to say what I'm saying. But what is the bigger danger? Is the bigger danger that we end up in World War III, or is the bigger danger that we discuss openly alternatives? Now, I have proposed since the special military operation started that we have to go to a new security and development architecture, which includes every single country on the planet. Now, this is in the tradition of the Peace of Westphalia. The Peace of Westphalia ended 150 years of religious war in Europe. The 30 Years' War was just the last phase of that. And it happened because people realized if they would continue to fight, there would be absolutely nobody left to enjoy the victory, because at that time, already one third of all people, villages, everything was destroyed. So then they sat down, they negotiated new principles for 4 years, and it ended up with the Treaty of Westphalia, which was the beginning of international law. Now, is that not the condition in which we find ourselves today in the age of thermonuclear weapons, that if we continue this, there will be nobody left to enjoy the victory? And should that not be an incentive to say we should find out how to create a global security and development architecture which takes into account the interest of everybody? Are we not the human species gifted with creative reason that we can solve any problem by thinking on a higher level to find a solution which is on a different plane than that in which the conflict arose? And I think right now, you know, I propose 10 principles, you know, how such a security architecture can function. You know, it has 7 very important principles concerning the economy and security issues. And then the last 3 ones are philosophical, of a more philosophical nature of how we have to change our thinking to arrive there. And I would hope that people respond to this. We already have found a great interest among many nations to, you know, because right now it's really a moral test of all of mankind. Are we capable of escaping a destiny, you know, which would end everything? Or are we capable of, you know, coming up with a solution to think otherwise? And, you know, I think the majority of people want to go in a different direction.
Yeah. You've mentioned that they're talking about militarizing Germany. Do you think that in the German government, do they really believe that Russia would attack Germany? And what would be the reason for Russia attacking Germany in their mind, in your opinion?
Well, I think various Russian leaders have said very clearly, you know, that there are red lines, and that, you know, for example, F-16 in Ukraine or foreign mercenaries would be met with appropriate answers, not only targeting those military equipment, but also the command centers from which the decision was made to deploy these. Now, that makes several targets in Germany prime targets, like Wiesbaden headquarters for this Ukraine operation, Ramstein, Büchel, where the US nuclear weapons are stationed, and others. So I do not exclude that, you know, if this continuous escalation continues, it could come to that. I think that the if you take away the provocations of NATO, I think there is no reason whatsoever, zero, nada, nothing. You know, Russia has no imperial intention. And to put this out as a lie, you know, to say, look, if we allow Putin to take all of Ukraine, then he will go to the Baltics and then Poland and then even other NATO countries. That is not proven. There is absolutely nothing. You know, there was a big incident in the German press official office where a journalist basically said, look, I want to see the proof. Show me the quotes where Putin said that. And they couldn't prove it because it does not exist. Professor Mersheimer, who is a moderate American professor, mainstream, you know, you cannot accuse him to be radical. He's very solid. He just made a very long documentation going into the prehistory of the Ukraine crisis. And he also makes emphatically the point that, you know, that there are many proofs that, Russia does not want any imperial expansion or return to the Soviet Union. One of these proofs is that, you know, when the special military operation started, Putin had very few troops at the Ukrainian border. He did not expect to have a large military operation. 4 days after the special military operation started, he already wanted to negotiate and, you know, come to terms with the Ukrainians. I think that this whole idea is just propaganda. And, you know, in Germany, by now, you are not even allowed to say these things. I mean, you are risking to be punished with fines. There is a tremendous effort to suppress any discussion of these issues. Now, there was an effort by the Interior Minister to even forbid totally unilaterally a magazine. Now, I don't agree with the content of that magazine, but, you know, what is at stake here is the First Amendment in the United States, or the freedom of opinion and freedom of press in the German Constitution as well. So they're trying to you know, basically to make people quiet about these questions. This is why I think, you know, why we have to go to social media in the global south to hopefully influence then some people who are listening in Europe. I mean, that's how far and how bad it has become. This is why your platform is really important, because I know a lot of people in Germany also watch it. So I want to thank you that you have me here.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. And the other thing right now would be the policy of Germany and, or maybe the European Union toward the conflict in the Middle East. Do you think that European Union was so cautious about what's going on in the Middle East? They're not happy with the situation, but it seems that they cannot participate any sort of effective way to influence the situation. But do you think that at the end of the day, do you see the capacity of participating in the conflict in the Middle East on the part of the European Union in order to bring some sort of sanity to this conflict that is getting totally out of the hand of the United States, in my opinion? What role would you consider for the European Union to play?
Well, I think that the fact that both the International Court of Justice in Den Haag and the International Criminal Court made very clear rulings, you know, condemning Netanyahu, who has an arrest warrant out for him. And basically, I think the final decision still is outstanding, but, you know, plausible genocide and all these formulations, which, however, did not prevent the German government to take clearly the side of Israel, which is tragic, you know. In a sense, they make the Palestinians pay belatedly for the crimes of the National Socialists, which is really terrible, terrible. But I think Joseph Borrell, who is the foreign, or was the foreign spokesman or foreign minister, so-called, of the EU, he made some cautious statements, but I don't think that they will break out of the control of the Anglosphere, the British and the United States. However, you know, I do not take the failure of certain institutions as the final word, condemning the rest of the world to doing nothing. You know, my late husband, Lyndon LaRouche, already in 1975 had proposed a plan for the Middle East called the OASIS Plan. This was the idea to, if you look at this region, it's all desert. You know, if you fly over it, hours and hours, yellow, yellow, brown, brown, no green tree, nothing. And many of the wars in the Middle East were around the scarcity of water, the control of water. So he proposed already in 75 the idea to produce lots of new fresh water through desalinization of large amounts of ocean water, through building of canals, irrigation. And at the time, he discussed it not only with the Iraqis, the Ba'ath Party, many leaders of the developing countries, but also Abba Eban, you know, from Israel. And more recently, you know, when this whole horrible situation in Gaza occurred, we reactivated that plan. We actualized it. We made an animation video showing, you know, this is all feasible. The Chinese, for example, they have greened a desert in the northeast of China of a territory of the size of Germany. You know, what was complete desert is now forest, agriculture, tourism. The farmers are becoming wealthy. So with modern technology, you can transform seemingly hopeless areas in the world, you know, and make them actually lush landscapes full of blue flowers and harvests and well-being for the people. So we started to organize for that. We already had two major conferences of the Schiller Institute with ambassadors, two Palestinian ambassadors from Copenhagen, from UNESCO, South African ambassador, other ambassadors from the region, where we presented the plan. And, you know, that idea started to catch on. And now we are planning, as soon as we can, a really big conference, hopefully even in Southwest Asia, where, you know, we would present all the plans, what could be done, how it would transform the living condition for the people. How, I mean, you have to give hope to young people, you know. I mean, look at right now, 20% of the people in Gaza are in acute starvation. I mean, there will be never peace if you just continue the way it is now. You have to have a vision how, I mean, the way I look at it is the entire region from India to the Mediterranean, from the Caucasus to the Gulf, this whole area is the potential hub for the connection between Asia and Europe, Asia and Africa. And it used to be that, you know, with the ancient Silk Road, you know, you had all of these cities, Samarkand, Damascus, you know, they were all parts of the ancient Silk Road where not only goods were exchanged, but technologies and culture, philosophy. And this region could have that role in the future. I mean, Baghdad was once the most advanced city in the world during the Abbasid dynasty. And, you know, there are some very wealthy countries who are building all kinds of majestic things. If we could convince some of them to invest only a portion of what they're doing into the economic infrastructure, you could have soon, you know, maybe in a couple of decades, you could have that region as dense, developed with infrastructure like you find it today in Europe. Germany, for example, is a country which has a very rich infrastructure, where you have waterways, highways, railways, all integrated. And dense infrastructure is a precondition to have advanced industry. So, you know, I can see very clearly how this region, which, you know, is now in the, you know, I mean, Iran, Saudi Arabia is about maybe to become part of the BRICS. Egypt is part of the BRICS. The Emirates are part of the BRICS already. India, how that whole region could really take up such a plan, like the OASIS plan, and start implementing it. And then young people, instead of thinking how to perpetuate revenge, would think, you know, how to become a teacher, a scientist, a musician, you know, how to build a future. And I think such a dramatic paradigm shift would really probably be what inspires the whole world, that cooperation is so much more advantageous than the present geostrategic hatred which is being pursued by some. So this Oasis plan, I think, is the hope for the region. And I don't know if the EU will do it. Maybe it will be countries like Italy. You know, they had, for example, politicians like Enrico Mattei, who was thinking in this direction already in the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, I think, you know, we could connect to these traditions and then Europe could play a productive role.
Yeah, that would be amazing, because having Russia, China, and the United States, maybe Iran, we have a new president in Iran as well, and they talk to each other, because right now we've learned that Azerbaijan is asking to be part of BRICS, and it seems that BRICS is getting more and more important in terms of the economy of the world, in terms of the political parties who are part of BRICS. And but at the end of the day, what matters the most is how we can connect the East and the West together, and to have some sort of political settlement, to have some sort of negotiations without having any sort of connection between Russia right now, for example, in the Middle East, or with the current situation between Iran and Israel. The United States would have, if there wasn't a war in Ukraine, they would have asked Putin to be part of this problem, to solve the problem between Iran and Israel. But having the conflict in Ukraine is just, it's impossible. There is no communication between the United States and Russia. And right now between Russia, even they've asked China to talk with Iran. But as you've mentioned, it's so important to have these connections, to negotiate, to talk. And it seems that we are losing this ability that we have had before.
Yes, it's true. That is why I think you need, I mean, look, China, for example, is playing a major role in the Ukraine crisis. They have an emissary who traveled just recently there to Ukraine and other countries. They are doing similarly in the Middle East. They just got the 13 Palestinian factions together. So I think, and they got the historic conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, maybe not solved forever, but they are talking again, there's diplomatic relations again. So I think China for sure is playing a very positive role. But unfortunately, in the Western media and Western think tanks, not only the image of Russia has been darkened, but increasingly the US is pushing decoupling, de-risking, you know, and the EU is dancing around saying, oh, maybe we don't want to decouple, but de-risking. This is all caving into the pressure of the United States. But I think that there is one realm where there is still a degree of freedom, and that is the global majority. Because, you know, I mean, Brazil, for example, Indonesia, Egypt, South Africa, these are all, and many others, these are all countries, India, they, you know, if they act together and say, we are the global majority and we have a right to have a voice. For example, next year, there will be the 70th anniversary of the Bandung Conference. And what you have seen through the rise of China, the non-aligned movement has a renaissance. You know, the non-aligned movement was already on a good way to have a new world economic order in the 60s, in the 70s, but you know, they were, you know, destabilized by counter forces at the time. But when China started its spectacular rise, you know, lifting 850 million people out of poverty, And then offering the Belt and Road Initiative, the new Silk Road for cooperation to many countries in the Global South. This gave these countries for the first time in history the possibility to overcome poverty and underdevelopment. And you have now more modern railways in Indonesia and Laos than in Europe or in the United States. So this is just the beginning. And already at the Bandung conference, Sukarno and Nehru said, you know, that neocolonialism exists, you know, one should watch out for it. And that existed in the form of the IMF conditionalities and the denial of credit for development, the World Bank being very selective what they would finance and what not. But now, with the new development bank headquartered in Shanghai, about which Lula said, you know, this will become the great bank of the Global South, there is the potential, you know, that all of these countries can actually take their own road to development. And, you know, there is a huge discussion among Africans, Asian countries. They do not want to be exporters of raw materials any longer. They want to have the value chain in their own country. They want to become industrial countries. They want to become, you know, middle-level income countries and have a good education system. And, you know, I keep saying to the Europeans, you know, if you would be not so ideologically off, for Europe to help the Global South to invest in 2 to 3 billion new productive jobs, which, you know, is what is needed. I mean, for example, Africa will have by the year 2050, 2.5 billion people. Now, that means Africa alone will need more than 1 billion new productive jobs for all these young people. And wouldn't it be better for the Africans, for the Europeans, for everybody else to do that rather than have thousands and thousands of young people, old people going through the Sahara, you know, dying of thirst, and those who make it through the Sahara then die by you know, drowning in the Mediterranean, and then have a migrant crisis, which, you know, some people are just, you know, going crazy about. Wouldn't it be better to really say, we help the Global South to finally overcome the relics of 500 years of colonialism, and we have the know-how, we have an interest to have a stable future economy, and we cooperate. So, you know, I think that we have to really get the voice of the Global South stronger to be heard. I think you should also, if I may give you this advice, why don't you invite people from Indonesia, from Brazil, from South Africa, and ask them, you know, what is your intention? You know, what is it what you want for the future? What role do you want the United States to play or the Europeans? You know, because I think we have to get the voices of, I think there are several countries who have quite exceptional leaders right now. Give them a voice so that the people in Germany who are only listening to the mainstream media can actually hear what is the aspiration of these countries. And I think that could help a lot to shape the debate, you know, and you know, because we are sitting all in one boat. You know, I think that because of nuclear weapons, because of the internet, because of pandemics, I don't think you can find a solution only for parts of the world and then have the rest of the world go under. I think we need to have a solution in which everybody can, you know, prosper, everybody can, you know, have a good life. And I think, you know, if I would not be fundamentally convinced that that is realistically possible, I would have despaired since a long time. But I see the trend of times going in this direction.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
It was my pleasure.